Welcome to East Belfast Speaks Out. I'm Mark Devonport, for those who don't know me, political editor at the BBC. This is actually the second debate that I've chaired in the course of a day. I was just saying to somebody, it must be like buses, you don't do anything for months, and then two debates come along at once. The one that I chaired earlier on today was at the Stormont Assembly, and they had lots of newfangled technology there where you were meant to vote during the course of the thing. It was seven different schools. Amongst the things that the newfangled technology told us was that of our younger generation, the general opinion of 88% of them was that local politicians were not good leaders. So we'll find out whether you agree with them tonight. 58% of the audience there at Stormont thought Stephen Nolan was awful, whereas 42% thought he was quite nice. And 63% of the seven schools assembled there liked my tie. The other 27% thought it was pretty awful. So anyway, we got that one out of the way. Unfortunately, we don't have any of those buttons and technology, but we do have a very distinguished panel, and we're looking forward to having a lively debate. To my left, the Secretary of State, Theresa Villiers, who has rushed here from London. She was answering Northern Ireland questions in the Commons at 11:30 this morning, so thanks very much for making the effort to be across here in East Belfast. Mike Nesbitt, who you'll know as Ulster Unionist leader, and this is the second time I've actually chaired him in a debate in the course of one day, so that must be some kind of a record. To my right, Deirdre Heenan from the University of Ulster, also known to many of you as a frequent contributor to our programmes, including The View. Alex Atwood from the SDLP, obviously former minister not so long ago in the Stormont Executive, but now seeking to regain the party's seat in the European Parliament, which is the only mention I'll allow of that all night. No more electioneering, Alex. And on the far side, the Employment and Learning Minister, Stephen Farry, who is one of the great survivors at Stormont, because we've been told now for, I don't know, how many months? Years?
Years.
That you were going to be axed, and you're still hanging on in there, Stephen. So, one of the great survivors. Now, as you know, the East Belfast debate doesn't really sort of follow set questions. I know some of you have given us sort of broad topics that we might discuss as we go along. But first of all, the general theme given by the organisers was, is the Assembly really working in the interests of the people? So I'm going to start off with a few thoughts from the panel, not necessarily all of them, and then I'll start throwing it open to you for your views. So first of all, Deirdre.
Oh, I wasn't expecting that. What was your question?
Is the Assembly working in the interests of the people?
Well, I think the big issue is whether or not we should have an opposition. And 15 years later, is the system that we were given under the Good Friday Agreement still fit for purpose? From a public perspective, I think there should be a wider debate on the possibility of an opposition and so-called normalisation of politics. Because then we'd be able to hold ministers to account, we'd hold MLAs to account, there'd be much more scrutiny, and I think people would find politics much more dynamic and engaging. As it is, for many people, it's a turn-off because it's moribund, because we seem to be in gridlock, logjam. If you look around at issues like education, we don't seem to move forward with the Education Skills Authority. We haven't moved forward on the big-ticket issues. And because we're consistently talking about them but seeming to go nowhere, I think it's a huge turn-off for the public and particularly the younger generation who should be getting engaged in so-called normal politics. So I think we need to look at the system and have a real informed debate to say, is the system as it was set up 15 years ago currently still fit for purpose? And if not, could we have an opposition with much more scrutiny, much more accountability? And I know people will say, oh, well, that's the committee system and that's what they're supposed to do. But anyone who looks at the committee system will know that always the party comes first before the object of the committee. So I think if we're talking about does it work, I would like to see a really informed debate about the possibility of the introduction of opposition and real opposition politics. Democracy is about dialogue, and I think we're really missing part of the piece.
OK, thanks very much, Deirdre, for that opening gambit. Stephen Farry, next Assembly election, is that time to change the system completely, move towards opposition?
Well, I think there's a whole host of reforms that we should be looking in the Assembly, such as the change to the designation system, the change in the way we form the executive. I wouldn't put a bet on those changes happening, but we will continue to make the case. In the meantime, the executive and the assembly are actually delivering in some respects, but for sure they are being massively overshadowed by the events over the past 12 months and the dominant narrative in terms of our politics, which has been played out on the streets. The system of government itself doesn't always lend itself to effective delivery. And in effect, when the DUP and Sinn Féin agree on something, I mean, they can be an unstoppable machine. Whenever they don't agree on something, we have a situation of deadlock, particularly on some of the most crucial issues in our society. That said, I mean, there is things that are happening. I mean, this is not a wasted mandate of the Assembly. There are individual ministers, I mean, and I would say across a range of parties, who are delivering within their own portfolios, and things are changing in a number of respects. I mean, if you look at some of the reforms to our health service that are proceeding, there's reforforms in my own department around our further and higher education skills apprenticeships that are taking place, of which we will see the benefits over a number of years. Looking down the road, I think there's still the scope for this particular mandate to deliver big ticket items. We're still looking for a lower level of corporation tax. If that is achieved within the next 12 months, at least in principle, that could be a game changer. So I think there's a real prize there for the politicians if they can actually get their act together and provide a coherent, cohesive government, and we can affect change. So I wouldn't utterly despair just yet, but for sure the performance to date isn't as good as people have a right to expect.
Okay, obviously, if anybody wants to get in on this specific issue in relation to the Assembly, how it works in opposition, stick up your hand and you can let me know and I'll try and call you. But Mike Nesbitt, I'll come to you next and I'll keep an eye out if anyone wants to get in on this particular issue.
Well, I think it's worthwhile looking back to the circumstances of 1998 and what the objective was in setting up a devolved government. And it was not to set up an efficient and effective set of government institutions. Shockingly, it was to wed people off violence and to persuade people that the way to go forward was in politics. And therefore, to achieve that, the primary objective was to create a set of institutions big enough to be inclusive. And that's why, for example, you have six MLAs in every constituency, making a total of 108, only to try and ensure that the small parties had a slice of the cake up at Stormont, and even at 108, one of the small parties on the Unionist Loyalist side didn't quite make it over the line. So 15 years on, things have changed. We are relatively stable, probably as stable as we're ever going to be, in terms of people who still resort to bombs and to bullets. We have gone through a recession. And people, quite rightly, I think, are looking at Stormont and saying, if survival is the best you can offer us, we're not interested. We want delivery. So the debate now is, how do we change and reform to a point where we can deliver? And I think that means fewer government departments, fewer MLAs, a greater focus on outcomes rather than processes. And at the core of it, introducing an official opposition is the next big step towards trying to normalise politics in Northern Ireland. And to get that, you're going to need, as I understand it, cross-community agreement up at Stormont, because nobody else, including the Secretary of State, is going to legislate for it. And what we might go on to debate is whether there is a credible option, in the absence of a formal opposition, of parties not taking up their right to be at the executive table.
Anybody want to get in before I go to another participant? Okay, on this point I'll go to Alex Atwood, because Alex, there is a debate going on within the SDLP as to whether you should move into opposition sooner rather than later.
I don't think it's much of a debate now, to be honest, and I'll come back to that. Like the first thing is to touch on, whereas I don't agree with what Mike said, I think his sentiment was right. That whatever the weaknesses and failures and fault lines of our politics today, and there are multiple and there are many, nobody should diminish the fact that we have got devolution, we have a united stand against terror, and that we had the new beginning to policing. And all of those were beyond us in the years of terror, paramilitary terror and state violence. And therefore, having those achievements, united stand against terror, the new beginning to policing and devolution, are immense, and they came at a terrible price, and they came after far too long a time, but they came nonetheless. But 1998 was the pinnacle of hope and ambition. It was that moment when the people of the North and the people of the island, not unanimously but in very substantial numbers, said that we want to transform the character of our island and our relationships and reach for something much bigger and greater. And in that regard, politics has failed. There's been achievements, they've been mighty, but the achievement of transforming life fundamentally has not happened. And what we've seen over the last period of time is the politics in this part of the world degrading. It has many expressions, but it is degrading before our very eyes. And it is degrading, in my view, because there are people who do not have the conviction and the commitment to the values that best can shape this island and the people in the north of the island in particular in the way that we need to. Okay. Whether there's an opposition or not, we can have that debate. But my observation on this government is that there are too many. Yes, there are too many who in and around government, who are in government but are not in power. The best government in these islands is the Scottish Nationalist government. Different contexts, they're a majority government, and so on. But if you look at the skill and craft and quality of Salmond, Sturgeon, Swinney, and the other Scottish ministers, they demonstrate that they know the difference between being in government and being in power. And I think that whatever about our structures, there are people who don't really know the difference between being in government and being in power.
We might come back to Scotland in more detail later, but there's one person on this panel who actually has the power potentially to change things, because it's down to you, Secretary of State, what you propose in any law. But so far, you have not gone for pushing through any kind of fundamental change to the Stormont system. What will trigger that?
I think to see more fundamental changes to the system at Stormont, you'd have to build a broadly based consensus across the political parties and across the community. Because that idea of inclusivity and sharing of power is crucial to the peace settlement that's transformed life in Northern Ireland. And we should never take that for granted. And that's why I think it's very important to approach this issue with caution. I think there is a case for reform. My party for some years has been supportive of a move towards a formal system of government and opposition. But any changes have to be consistent with the power-sharing principles and the mutual respect, which is inherent in the Belfast Agreement. But I think in terms of the broader question you asked about whether the Assembly is delivering, I think that for any administration, for any government, the last few years have been extremely difficult. You know, we've been coming through one of the most severe recessions of the 20th century. We're dealing with the worst deficit crisis since World War II. That does constrain the options for any administration, whether it's a national one or whether it's a devolved one. I know it's clear now that, you know, the focus is now on delivery on things like the economy, on building social cohesion. And the UK government is working closely with the executive on those issues, and that's one of the reasons why we signed an economic pact. But I think it is important to point to some of the successes that have been delivered by the executive, not least of which is some very striking successes on inward investment.
OK, let's go over to the audience to see at the back. I think Trevor Rigland was wanting to get a quick word in.
Just a very quick word. If the government has to be a cross-community government, then the opposition has to be a cross-community opposition. Is there any evidence of those parties who would form that opposition showing that they actually can work together in a constructive way to create a viable alternative government in opposition and in waiting to actually take over the government at some stage?
Any other points or not? Yeah, sorry, the gentleman here. If you just hang on, we'll get a microphone to you so everyone can hear you. Hang on a moment. Okay.
I'm just finding it difficult to grasp. I don't believe that the government that we have at the moment has any power whatsoever, because there's 108 MLAs up on the hill. But you yourself, now, you've given more power to seven people in a parades commission that can overrule the whole government. Seven unelected quango, you've given them the power to overrule the whole country.
Thought we'd get to flags quite quickly in parades. Mm-hmm. We've got there. Yourself in the front. Sorry, gentleman in the front here.
I'd just like to dispute one of the Secretary's points about delivery. I was actually looking there last night there about peace walls, you know, considering that the executive was supposed to commit to removing them by 2022. But considering that another went up there at St. Matthews, I'd sort of have to question its credibility. Thanks.
Okay. Sorry, Jim Wilson, quick point.
Yes, just a point of information for the panel. In 1974 in Longcash, the Loyalist groupings actually set the format for what the government is now up in Stormont. In 1974, and was refused by all the political parties at the time. And it's in a book called Tony Novosel. So check back in their history that a lot of years back, these things could have been achieved when Loyalist groupings had set that format out.
Okay, well, let's bounce back with some of those points. Well, first of all, you know, why should the Parades Commission have the sway over these kind of sensitive issues when you've got 108 elected politicians up there not so far away?
Well, a very conscious decision was made to take these decisions away from the old system, which made the decision vested it in the police and put them right in the centre of extremely difficult political decisions. And also a very conscious decision was made to keep these decisions out of the political arena by setting up an independent body. The reality is that the decisions they take are inevitably going to cause controversy. It's essential that their decisions are obeyed and the rule of law is respected. But I do think, you know, it's absolutely right that the Richard Haass Working Group is looking at ways in which the system can be improved and decision-making can be improved, and we can broaden the community support for this area of policy. I think there is certainly... it's important that... the Haass Group takes this issue seriously because of the corrosive and destabilising effect some of the street protests that we've seen can have. So I welcome the work of the Richard Haass Group, and I'll certainly consider very seriously the proposals they come up with on parading.
Just on the parades, Commissioner Mike Nesbitt, obviously it was thought when the Richard Haass Group started that that might be, if you like, the most obvious thing that they would come up with, a replacement quango for the Parades Commission, because there had been a previous deal between the DUP and Sinn Féin. Sinn Féin published their submissions. They say, no, they want a strengthened Parades Commission, that they've taken that entirely off the table. So are we going to see any change on that score or not?
Well, I hope so. In terms of Sinn Féin publishing the position, I consider them to have acted in bad faith, because I will say this. When Richard Haass and Megan O'Sullivan came in mid-July and the five leaders of the executive parties endorsed them conducting the process, Richard Haass asked two things of the party leaders, the first of which was that we would respect the confidentiality of the process and not publish our papers, because if we did, we would compromise the process. And he asked one other thing, and given I've signed up to confidentiality, I can't tell you what the second thing is. But Sinn Féin, yeah, they have published their papers. I don't know why, because it is always very difficult to shift from a public position. I happen to think of the three issues of flags, parades, and dealing with the past. Parades is probably the one where is the best chance of getting some traction in terms of agreeing a way forward. For me, you start with the right to assembly and parade as enshrined in Article 11 of the European Convention of Human Rights. And then you look at what sort of regulatory body you would want. And you would say to them, don't just look at the impact on a community if a parade comes through their area. Look at the impact on the other community if their parade is not allowed to follow its traditional route. Have a bit of balance and have more transparency than the current Parades Commission currently operates. And then you might find yourself building a consensus for the way forward.
Alex, how would you see a replacement to the Parades Commission coming out of the Haass talks?
Well, what I don't see is coming out of the Haass talks, the 2010 proposals of Sinn Féin, the DUP, that saw decision-making on parade disputes being located in the office of First and Deputy First Minister. And what you would have had in those circumstances, if that were to now emerge, that you would have the fault lines of Northern politics placing parades located in the highest office in the land. And in my view, it would be a very retrograde step. But from what I understand, the marching orders are not supportive of the 2010 legislation. And I understand that Sinn Féin are not now in support of the 2010 legislation. and that they have now found a faction for the Praise Commission. It's only 3 or 4 years ago where they said the Praise Commission was, quote, cheerleaders for sectarianism and obsolete. Now they say that the Praise Commission has to be enhanced. There has to be a regulatory body. That regulatory body has to be outside OFM, DFM. And I think that when you work this through, a regulatory body like the Praise Commission, with further transparency and accountability, with everybody accepting that whether we like it or not, the rule of law has to prevail, and that includes determinations of the Praise Commission, and basing all that in a proper rights context, I think there's opportunities to take this issue forward. But if somebody thinks that the prize of the head of the Praise Commission is going to be secured in these talks, it's not going to be. And in that regard, I regret the decision of this Secretary of State not to reappoint the current membership of the Praise Commission after their difficult work over a hard summer.
Okay. Stephen Farrell, I want you to address both the Praise Commission point, whether that's going to be replaced as a result of the House vote, and also the gentleman here was pointing out that the credibility of the executive, on the one hand having this target for bringing down the peace walls, on the other hand putting up whatever you call it, a curtain, a wall, a barrier in East Belfast. What does that say about its credibility?
Well, first of all, in terms of parades, there is the potential for a replacement to the Praise Commission being agreed. I don't see that being feasible, however, on a standalone basis. And I think it's important that we do see the current House talks as being a package around three issues. And I think there has to be an expectation of progress on all three, because I don't think you will see progress on one being possible without progress on three emerging. There's no point in simply just replacing the Praise Commission for Praise Commission's sake. I think there needs to be an understanding of the underlying issues as to why the current system is causing frustrations, and we have to dig deeper. And the problem is that we do not have common adherence to an agreed understanding of what is meant by the rule of law or what is meant by shared space. And what I mean by that is that on both sides of various arguments, people will cite issues of rule of law, in the sense that the other side are not abiding by it. They will cite that the other side aren't respecting shared space, but there's never any acknowledgement of those issues in terms of their own particular arguments. Whenever we get to the stage where people are prepared to actually call back on their own side and see a global perspective as to what's going on, then will we really be making progress on those types of issues. In terms of the issue around peace walls, I mean, there is a target over the next 10 years of reducing those. I mean, it is going to be something to be taken sensitively in discussions with local communities, not something that can be imposed, but we do need to be ambitious in that regard. And there will be times whenever we do try to take steps forward that occasionally there may well be what is perceived as being a step back, and that is the case in terms of what has happened in East Belfast around St Matthews. It's important to stress and appreciate, I mean, this can become maybe a point of dancing on the head of a pin around detail, that it is not a permanent barrier. It is something that is there on a temporary basis to provide protection as and when is required. But it is not something that I think anyone has any appetite for doing, but was something that had to be done in the very particular circumstances we find ourselves. But the long-term aspiration over the next 10 years is to see a serious reduction in the number of peace lines. We should also bear in mind as well that we have a lot of unofficial interfaces in Northern Ireland, both in urban areas and rural areas. They may not be marked by a wall or some sort of physical barrier, but they're there in the way people move about or otherwise don't move about. So we have to also tackle those. And that lies, again, in terms of a much more stronger commitment to shared space, yep. Shared housing, integrated education.
OK, thanks, Stephen.